Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another Remap interview. We spent the last few months talking a lot about giant monsters and specifically Godzilla, and our discussion about Godzilla Minus One, our discussion about Shin Godzilla. Back at Waypoint, we had a great conversation years ago about 2014's Godzilla, which is one of my all-time favorite blockbusters and interpretations of Godzilla. I think it has just an incredible sense of scale. So today, we're excited to be joined both by my colleague, Rob Zachney. Hello, Rob.
Hello, hello.
And Sean Conrad, who was a visual effects supervisor on the most recent Apple TV Plus show Monarch: Legacy of Monsters, which ties into the Monsterverse that was established in that 2014 film by Gareth Edwards, and has worked in visual effects on many, many things. Go ahead and look up Sean's IMDb. But for the purposes of sort of this show and this conversation and our conversations about Godzilla, that includes the Monarch show, the 2014 Godzilla, and 2019's Godzilla, King of the Monsters. Sean, we are so excited to be able to talk to someone that actually knows something about Godzilla instead of us yammering into microphones pretending to do so.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much, guys.
What leads you to Godzilla? So, like, now you're a visual effects supervisor, like more of a managerial role, but in 2014's Godzilla, my understanding was, like, you're an artist. You're in the Godzilla mines. Like, you're there, like, tweaking heat ray, like, spines. Like, what brings you to working on that original Gareth Edwards film?
It's an interesting, like, you know, Godzilla as a property, as a license, you know, it wasn't really one of those seminal films for me growing up, but when Bong Joon-ho's The Host came out, which is an amazing, amazing film about, you know, it's a parable for this environmental disaster that happened in Seoul because of the American military dumping a bunch of formaldehyde into the Han River. So, like, once that came out, it made me think, oh, I should go back and rewatch some Godzilla films. And, like, you know, rewatching that original, you know, 50s Godzilla, like, it really opened my brain a lot to what these kinds of big monster movies could really be and the stories that they could tell. And so, you know, I was working at, you know, this company, MPC. I joined that place to work on, you know, I was a stereographer when I joined that place, and I joined to work on briefly Life of Pi. Like, I didn't really have very much to do with that movie, but
what's a stereographer?
A stereographer, right. So a stereographer is like, so basically a stereographer, when you're shooting a movie in stereo 3D, like the two eyes, you're putting on the glasses and stuff like that, you typically need somebody who will do the technical legwork of making sure the left and right eye have parity. You need to, you know, QC the plates as they come in, make them actually, like, you're shooting one plate through a mirror. And so the specular highlights between the two won't line up. So you have to run a process where you make them line up. You have to realign any camera things like that. So I was doing that really sort of rote, banal work. And then I was working on this, like, you know, speaking of my IMDb, there's a lot of trash in there, but I was working on...
Hey, I almost started this by asking you about your experience on Hollow Man 2, but I didn't.
I consulted on a software thing, so that nothing. So I was working on Jack the Giant Slayer, which I worked on for something like 18 months, which was, you know, interesting. I transitioned off of that and started doing more compositing, which is what my background originally was. So, you know, I was a lead on a couple of projects, and then MPC had done the pitch reel for the Gareth Edwards Godzilla 2014. So there's this like pitch reel that played at Comic-Con and was sort of circulated as like, hey, here's a tone piece of what we're going for.
Oh, that's one of my all-time favorite pieces of Godzilla media. Like, if you have not seen the original Comic-Con kind of teaser trailer that establishes a lot of the visual aesthetic that would then be expanded on in the 2014 movie, it's unbelievable. I haven't watched it in years. This is what's going to get me to go back and watch that. And I'm going to get Rob to watch that too, because I doubt he's seen it, but it's fantastic.
Yeah. And so like, I saw that pitch reel going around when I was at the office, and I was like, huh, I really want to work on this. And at the time, the supervisor who was going to be doing that project was, for MPC, was not like, he didn't have the greatest reputation. And so I was a little nervous about it. And he ended up, for health reasons, not being able to do it. And they brought in this guy, Guillaume, who had just done Life of Pi. And I knew casually because of that. And so I managed to get on as a project lead. And yeah, it was a really, you know, interesting, fruitful, defining project for my career in hindsight. You know, at this point, looking back on it, I've probably spent like 4 years of my professional career dealing with Godzilla in some way or another. So like, you know, 10% of my life.
One thing I was curious about is just how much variance is there between how well directors integrate VFX with their production, right? Like Gareth Edwards, I love his Godzilla film. I think one of his early films was, Patrick, do you remember the name of it? It's
Monsters.
The one,
famously he did a lot of the visual effects himself, like on a laptop.
He did it all. Like, he used to be, I think he was a flame operator editor for years. So he really fundamentally understood the technology and how to squeeze as much as he could out of his limited skill set and out of, like, you know, a reasonable time frame for the film. And, you know, it's such a crazy way to do visual effects, but like, it's undeniable. And, you know, that's more recently been emulated by the Everything Everywhere All at Once production team, where they kind of just did it all themselves because they had no budget for it.
But that's kind of what I'm curious about, is like, how different can the experience of doing your job be depending on who's steering the ship and how well they understand how to integrate VFX techniques with how they make movies?
Yeah, it can be a really huge difference. I've been pretty fortunate that most of the directors that I've had direct exposure to have been very VFX savvy and really appreciated it as part of their craft. Like Gore Verbinski used to do flame work as well. So it's like, you know, I worked on, again, maybe another questionable movie, but The Lone Ranger. And he was just like really in there, knew how to do everything, was really clear on it. You know, I've worked with Bob Zemeckis, who technology has been a really clear part of his trajectory for the last 20 years, for his entire filmmaking career, really. But, you know, especially the digital side of it, he's been really like at the forefront of it. And so, you know, I've been really fortunate about it. And going on to this project, it was really exciting because I was hired on this season of TV for Monarch in November 2021, and we didn't start shooting until, you know, July the next year. So I was in, while they were scripting, I was like hired around the same time as the production designer, before any directors, before cast, because Legendary as a studio and Apple as a network fundamentally feel like visual effects is part of their workflow, is part of their like budgeting and creative strategy. And knowing that we need sufficient lead time to do things competently is like intrinsic to getting a good product.
How does that matter? Because like one thing I'm always, and maybe this is so basic that it doesn't come up, but like one of the things that I look at as a place where I just see so many opportunities for it to go wrong is previs. And another podcast I do, A More Civilized Age, is all about the Clone Wars cartoons and Rebels. And some unproduced episodes, all you have is the pre-visualization of the intended shots. And from my understanding, these really rough, semi, you know, digital storyboard-esque things are really critical to planning out what we're going to do and to make sure there's not a ton of wasted work. But if I weren't, if I didn't speak VFX natively, right? If I were an old school movie person and someone shows up with some of the pre-viz renders of like, this is how this is going to work. Trust me, it's going to look awesome. That would scare the hell out of me. I would have a very hard time trusting, like, cause what if you're wrong? And I'm curious, cause I have heard like some old school Hollywood people would really like to see work much further along before they started offering feedback, effectively asking the work to be redone. And I'm curious, like, is that kind of where it shows up? The ability to trust the effects house to actually deliver on the vision? Where does the relationship take off and where does it break down? You know, when there's alignment versus when there's kind of a lack of understanding.
It's a great question. And like the way that to sort of maybe reframe it a bit is previs is often like an adjunct to storyboarding. So typically a director will storyboard a scene before they actually previs anything. And a lot of your basic, like your key shots, your big conceptual ideas will be laid out, you know, pen and paper with a storyboard artist. And that's a convention that most executives, most filmmakers understand implicitly. You know, there's very few filmmakers doing technically complex filmmaking who show up to set without storyboards on a giant action sequence. You know, some people might go for it, like a little bit of like the pre-visualization work that like David Leitch does as a director is often, you know, the stunt team will shoot a scene, you know, and then he'll embellish on top of that with a couple of storyboards to help frame things up. But, you know, the way that previs is just basically like a moving storyboard. And a lot of what previs ends up helping you realize earlier than, you know, when you shoot it is like what kind of coverage you're missing. Like in the first episode, Matt Shackman, our director, who's, you know, very VFX experienced and understood it, you know, he had these really amazing storyboards that he gave to us and we put it together as a really rough cut. And, you know, as we were putting it together, we realized like, oh, we're missing Billy while he's holding Keiko precariously above the edge. We need to see his reaction and get his emotional state. And, you know, the show is really about our characters more so than the action or in conjunction with the action. So like we need to center those characters as much as possible in those action sequences. So like, you know, those kinds of tweaks happen. All that being said, you know, there is like a level of abstraction that happens where, you know, like you'll get to post, you'll do a post-viz pass on top of a pre-viz pass. So you'll shoot the darn thing and then you'll put it all into a post-viz pass with the same company that did the pre-viz usually. And at that point, you know, you may get a bunch of additional notes that were problems present in the pre-viz, or, you know, you'll then render the scene and like some of the more specifics, especially character animation, you might start to get notes on, you know, like attitude and design and other things like that, that in an ideal world, you would get that sooner. But again, because there's a level of abstraction, it's like, it's difficult. And so some studios, some networks have a, you know, a little bit more, you know, flexibility. And sometimes that's just because like, you know, you do the post-viz and you look at the scene and things aren't fundamentally working, right? Like one example in our show is the Frostvark, one of like my favorite creatures that we did. It's the ice creature in episode 4. This big monster that's like a cross of a pangolin, like a mammalian creature with a bunch of plates covering his body. And then a star-nosed mole is this like creepy mole creature that has these appendages sticking out from its face. And so this is a giant mashup of the two of those things. And we originally like conceived this creature as not having a mouth. And, we wanted its like face to be the appendages and like try to emote through them. And a thing that we realized once we put the post-viz together and was pointed out by Apple is just like, with the scene economy, it was really difficult to sell the idea that this is his face and you weren't getting those like jump reactions out of it. So then you go back, you redesign, you give it a big scary mouth and teeth and, you know, and then it allows you to do some of the things that are maybe like a little bit cliche, but cliche for a reason, like having a creature roar at camera or roar off screen from camera. It like lets the audience connect with it. And, you know, in a feature film, if that sequence was like not just longer in terms of the visual effects count, but longer in terms of the action, then you might be able to sell that idea a little bit better. But when you're constricted by, you know, episodic timelines, it sort of changes the convention that you're working with. And, you know, that change was actually the right thing to do. There is definitely like some movies you're just reshuffling the deck a little bit. Like you're not really making things better. You're just changing, you know, where bits of action happen. And, you know, maybe it is better, but it's like 0.02% better. So there is, and it's really like, it's not like common to one studio, one network, one filmmaker. It kind of is just situational to what the story is that you're trying to tell. It drives people crazy, though.
Well, I was thinking about this because you mentioned Life of Pi, which I think like that won awards for effects, right? But if memory serves, I think it was also financially ruinous for some of the houses contracted to work on the film.
Yeah,
just because of like, well, I don't know why. My I always sort of associate with like, well, that was Ang Lee, right? Yeah. I just sort of assumed like old school director, you know, maybe sort of misalignment there. But that was sort of what put me in mind of it was that was a really lauded piece of effects work and also a cautionary tale about like, be careful about some of the jobs you land.
You know, the part of the issue there is like Rhythm and Hughes had done a couple of deals back to back and Digital Domain sort of followed up later where they tried to get, you know, points on box office. And that stuff is like, you know, there's the cliche of Hollywood accounting, you know, mm-hmm. it obscures people's and studios and companies' rights to portions of that revenue. But, you know, like everybody knows that. And so, you know, a studio making that deal is like, I just like when I found out that that's what they had done, I was just like, oh my God, why would you do this? And, you know, you have like a history with a filmmaker, you know, and you want to, the upfront revenue isn't there because you aren't sure, you know, the studio isn't sure if this thing is going to be a hit. Like it's a really challenging story. Like it doesn't quite fit into, hey, this is like your summer blockbuster tentpole film.
Right.
So like you take a risk and sometimes that pays off and sometimes that doesn't. And to me, like, you know, at this point, every single executive I know who runs a visual effects studio will never make a deal like that again, because it's just like, it's impossible to actually get money on the timeline that you need to run a studio.
Speaking of timelines, one of my favorite graphics is every time there's a new incarnation of Godzilla, you can just sort of map on a chart.
Yeah.
That the boy's gotten a little bit bigger this time. That's sort of where we are with the character. And I think that speaks to the sense of scale and awe that Godzilla as a character sort of, you know, was engineered to get out of that original 50s film and continues to be a huge attraction of why Godzilla remains a spectacle to this day, a character that we keep revisiting in different forms, interpreted in different cultures, even. And so someone that's, that worked as close as manipulating like the heat ray of Godzilla to now overseeing different monsters of different scale across this kind of interpretation of Godzilla and sort of the monsterverse. I just wonder how you think about scale with these characters, because we do have this sense that they just keep getting bigger. I think partially as a consequence of visual effects allowing you to just think bigger than you can accomplish with a man in a suit. But as someone who's been in the trenches and is now thinking about these creatures on a broader scale, when you're thinking of a whole television show, just how do you conceptualize them as scale relative to how you sort of portray them in the films and TV projects?
Yeah, so scale is like, it's a lot of it comes just from composition. And I think that like you can go back and read Gareth Edwards' interviews and for Godzilla 2014, the way he wanted to think about the film is basically he wanted it to be like he was photographing a sports event or something. So you have all of these cameras and these fixed points on the field, and the monsters are fighting each other, and so you switch those vantage points to like where the action is in a specific thing, in a specific moment. But he wanted to create this sort of verite sense to the cameras where, you know, often the monsters are too big to fit in the frame. The camera operator may pan over and only catch the monsters for a few seconds before they blast out of the frame or it's obscured by a building. And so that like filmmaking convention really like allows us to sort of contextualize scale. So, you know, everybody knows what the size of a skyscraper is now. Like you can contextualize that relative to Godzilla. But then the added element of like, okay, you're shooting this inside of a, you know, office building, you know, allows you to do it, to start to gain that sense of scale out of the imagery. And then beyond that, like a lot of the digital side of this that we were able to really play with is it almost became like painting, where we would stack up atmospherics, which would then be another level of complexity in the scale, so that, you know, you have like little bits of smoke elements that were like practical photographed things, and then you would, you know, paste them around the area, and then you would, you know, put something, you know, you'd stack that up around his feet because he's kicking up dust all around there, and then you'd put some stuff in front of him because there's residual dust from him tearing through a building somewhere else, and then you put something up in the atmosphere around him, and then you shadow that part of his body to get like a sense of a gobo. And though all those like techniques start to, you know, individually give you like 3 or 4% more believability in the scale. And that's where like, you know, with a suit, a guy in a suit, you can't really like, you know, create that sense in a post way, because all the lighting is baked in, where like, you know, in visual effects, we can control the lighting in a post sense, and we can control that lighting on like a compositing point of view. So like compositing is this step in the visual effects process where everything is lit and rendered, animated, and you get those renders and you put it all together, and then you spend a ridiculous amount of time trying to like refine everything. And so like that movie was, for me, Godzilla 2014 was the most like painting I've ever done, where it would be like, you know, we're sticking in these tiny elements to try to bring together this picture, and it's all very bespoke in a way. As things have changed, it's a lot easier to just like render that. So, you know, you can actually just stick like a big volume of smoke everywhere and have it do things optically correctly.
So it's more like tools are taking care of things that you're like doing in a more hands-on approach. Like, I don't know, simplistic, but it's like drop down menu, like add smoke to scene. Like, I'm just like curious, like how much is like how you end up in a place where these elements are a little more automated or easier to do than it is like you, as you described it, painting onto a scene.
Yeah, it's you know, one, the simulation times are just a lot faster. So you can like take a simulated smoke element, you know, every time in Godzilla 2014, when Godzilla moves his arm, there's this one smoke element that Guillaume, our supervisor, loved. He called it the swirl. And
I'm starting to worry about how long it takes the swirl to render.
Oh, the swirl is just a photographed element. So it's like a guy with a leaf blower with a bunch of dry ice and smoke on a soundstage.
Okay, amazing.
And so he's doing like, he's like whipping the leaf blower around, and you're getting this effect of like this turbulating smoke in this way that is really appealing. And it's like, you know, it was shot on film, this element that we're talking about, like 10 years before, I think it was maybe shot for a Harry Potter movie or something. Mm-hmm. And so like you start, we started like every single time there, like the Muto was flying and beating its wings, you would put a little bit of hint of that, or like Godzilla would raise his hand. You'd get like this, I think probably if you had to do a count, that one smoke element is in the final act of Godzilla 2014, probably about 1,000 times.
Oh man. When I've been meaning to rewatch it since like a 4K version of it came out. And now I might have to see if I can sit down and do a smoke count.
and so, you know, maybe I'll try to find one and I'll send it to you as a YouTube from your YouTube clip.
Excellent.
Or something.
Thank you.
But you know, you these days, what you would do is put like an actual volume in there and then do a simulation, because it's not going to take an effects artist, you know, 2 weeks to get the element that you want it to do to be for the shot. You're still going to add elements like that to help define, you know, characteristics and movement and shape. And sometimes those 2D elements are still like the most essential thing you can really have to add scale and believability to a scene, but it's not resting entirely on it in the same way that we did back in the day. And beyond that, like, you know, the resolution that you can simulate things on is just a lot better. The entire like modality of rendering has changed since the 2014 film. Mm-hmm.
I want to say, I saw like a quote, I think it was from you, about talking about the difference in the Godzilla model from the 2014 film and then like incorporating that model into the television show, in which I think you described it as an asset. It was like, by merely bringing a similar asset into like the new techniques, like a technology available now, allowed you to see like finer details in this asset that was created for a film, you know, nearly a decade ago.
The way that, the original 2014 film was rendered in RenderMan, and it was their shadow mapping modality, which it's called Reyes, REYES, which sounds like rays, which is confusing because it sounds like ray tracing. The newer version is RIS, RIS. And that is basically like the difference between, you know, like a video game shadow mapping engine versus like true proper ray traced shadows, mm-hmm. and everything like that. And so one of the things with the shadow mapping is that like the render times for high detail textures were like really, really crazy. And so sometimes you would just like smear some of that detail if you weren't really going to be seeing it.
What's the amount of time? Can you like give us like a sense of scale? Like when you say the rendering time is really long, like what is?
Oh, I mean,
what does that mean?
Like days, you know?
Okay,
like,
okay. Yeah, okay. That's a good sense of scale.
And especially like RenderMan has always sucked with volumetrics.
Okay,
it sucks less now, like significantly less now. But, you know, the way that a volumetric would render would often be like flickery as hell if you actually had proper volumetric hard shadows going through it. And now it's like, oh, you can get something that looks pretty decent out of the box and then put it in a scene, and like a compositor can actually like work with it, where before you just be like, okay, I'm going to have to hack the heck out of this with a ton of like additional 2D elements to make it actually look presentable. And so, you know, like it, all of that stuff is like a lot easier. You can just say like in episode 6, the company that did the Godzilla rising out of the mountain scene. Mm-hmm. So we have the scene where Godzilla is taking a nap embedded in the side of a mountain. our heroes are on his back. He rolls over and then stands up and then walks away. And it's dramatic because Godzilla standing up is dramatic. But they rendered the full, like, full aerial perspective, like all of the volume of atmosphere between the camera and Godzilla. And that was really useful because then you get, like, you know, volumetric God rays, volume rays kind of coming off the side of him in very subtle ways that just, like, brings a sense of believability and scale to the render that wasn't really possible before. Now, all of this was technically possible. It just would be, like, resource impossible to really do it. And
you got to ship a movie just like you got to ship a video game. And, like, it's just, you got to pick and choose your battles, I guess.
And even then, like Weta doesn't render that kind of pass, which is, like, because it's still expensive. You know, it's still, right, like, really, you know, like, you're talking about, you know, Godzilla these days might be like 2 hours to render or, you know, something like that. And maybe less than that, depending on the renderer, depending on how big he is in frame and all that kind of stuff. Maybe, you know, probably even as low as 15 minutes for if he's smaller in frame. But, you know, then these volume passes, like all of that stuff, water, things with a lot of transparency can then turn into a lot of difficult, complicated calculations.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
One thing I was curious about when I think about, like, Godzilla 24 and just the entire field, but, like, particularly that movie, when I think about it, like, one of the things that I really love about it is that it operates in these different modes, right? Like, I think it really, like, it's really encapsulated, I think, by the time Godzilla reaches San Francisco and we get the arrival, which is shot very, like, almost ground level documentary style with, you know, your perspective as people on the bridge, the nurse character sort of retreating to the shelters. And then we get the sort of, like, biblical mythic halo drop into the vortex. But one of the things that's, like, amazing about that movie is, like, it shifts these modes and it, like, finds this different gear at the end, and visually it's all very cohesive. It feels like you are now entering a different like phase of the film, a different sort of visual language, a different sort of, like, visual storytelling happening. But also, like, a lot of that is going to be digital effects, right? Like, this isn't stuff that is necessarily a director of photography is sitting there being like, this is how this is all going to look. And I'm curious, when we're talking about, like, visual style and cohesiveness and that ability to say, like, you know, this entire sequence is going to have this vibe, this atmosphere, this is going to be the aesthetic that we're going to achieve here. How is that alignment achieved, right? Like, where does it begin? Who hands out the marching orders? Like, where, like, how do all the different pieces of the team working on a denouement like that come together to understand, to put together something so visually cohesive out of all these disparate parts?
A lot of work and iteration is really the answer. You know, like, one of the things that visual effects is useful for as a filmmaking tool is that we're not bound by what we shot. We can, you know, be more flexible and with that flexibility, it allows you to work on things in the edit and bring that cohesiveness together. And I think that, like, sometimes our industry is criticized for not respecting that cohesiveness. And I think, you know, a lot of that really is just down to time and, you know, the budget as well. Like, if you're fixing giant problems in post, and sometimes, you know, things don't necessarily look right. Like, The Host is a movie whose visual effects do not hold up at all. But like, the emotional thing you get out of it is still there. So like, it can be really, really challenging. Like, for me, as a person who's on set, you know, like 50% of the time when these things are being shot, like on an episodic, we shoot two episodes concurrently, and I'm working with previs and I'm turning things over to visual effects vendors. We had like 16 vendors. So my job is like, you know, all over the place every single day. And so, but when I'm on set, you know, I can observe like how they're thinking about things. And, you know, when you do a project like Monarch, before you start shooting, all of the department heads need to get on a call with the network and the studio. So network is Apple, producing studio is Legendary. And they need to explain how they are going to creatively do the show. So one of the things that, like, our DOP, Jess Hall, for the first two episodes, and you know, when you do a pilot, you hire like people who have done pilots before or who are have like a, you know, great ambition in order to like set the tone and set the filmmaking style for an episodic production. And so Jess Hall, like, he's our DOP, he had this idea of like wanting to shoot everything close up, wide angle, to get that cinematic quality out of the film. And that was a really like interesting revelation of like, okay, well, I can carry that now into post, where if we have to go to an all CG shot, we're not going to put the, you know, close up of Godzilla on a 150 millimeter lens and then blur out the background. We are going to be like wide and sharp as possible if we're like looking tight on his face. So then there's that a coherence that kind of like comes along for the ride once everybody starts getting into that same mental space. And beyond that, like with Gareth, you know, I think that a lot of it is, you know, he had like a vague idea of how that third act was going to be coming together, and he prevised a lot of things, but that third act evolved like crazy. Like, and he had shot a lot of things of, you know, guys reacting to things in office buildings or on rooftops or whatever. And he had no idea how he was going to use those things. But the reason it kind of works is because he had this idea of like, okay, this is this sporting event that we're watching from these angles, and we're going to, our cameras are going to be, have a little bit more of a handheld feel. Like he really, it's not big, deliberate crane operated stuff in the same way that you would, you know, do on like our show is very like crane operated, you know, smooth camera move, heavy kind of thing. But like for us, you know, we took a lot of those lessons and said, okay, we're doing something fundamentally different because we have to fit not only the genre conventions of Godzilla 2014, but you know, King of the Monsters comes shortly after when our show takes place. And then, Kong Skull Island is like a very tonally different kind of film. And so we
yeah, it is.
and they're all great, but like, you know, our director, Matt Shackman, had to figure out how do you bring all these things together. And then my job as a department head is to listen to my director, you know, and listen to our showrunner, Chris Black, and our executives who all have ideas about tone and how to achieve it. And really, like, that coherency comes together if you have enough time and you have enough space to iterate. It doesn't if you are trying to like jam everything into, you know, 2 months of post or something.
It almost sounds like part of your role on set, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is almost like internalizing the visual language of the director and how the show is being shot on set physically, so that when it is moved to the digital realm, you are like this primary consultant for like, this is how it's looking, this is what we're trying to achieve, and here's how we can maintain that consistency when we're, you know, working in on the computers and doing that part of making the show come together.
And you know, like, it, some days you'll be on set and like the what am I like? I think of fundamentally all of our directors of photography understood how they were going to approach these problems. But there is one day when we were on set and our characters are going through the ruins of San Francisco and we're shooting in this location really close to my house. And, you know, the camera tilts up from them and they tilt up to see the ruined Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco. And, you know, we're looking down this alley and we see some buildings on the left and right of frame. And really the focal point is this. And so, you know, we shot that at night. They had to put up, you know, a lot of like lights to get the frame, you know, to get the frame like actually readable. And once all that like lighting setup was done, we just had a giant lens flare as we tilted up. And so I went over to the director of photography and I'm like, is this a shot about a lens flare or is this a shot about the Transamerica Pyramid? And he's like, of course, you know. And so like your job then is to like look at the image, help everybody visualize it. And it's not like, sometimes that can be a really frictious relationship where like a director of photography is going to be like, I don't have the time to get to your note. And then they move on and you have to deal with garbage. but like, again, fortunately, like I think this industry is really evolving in the last, you know, 10 years where
sure
everybody understands that visual effects is part of it, you know, like the conventions of how visual effects works with the production are more coherent. Like, you know, most of the time in an ideal world, I should have very little to do on set because we planned everything before we go to set, you know? And we bring everybody into like, okay, these are what the primary setups are going to be. And this is what we need to get out of it. But there's little things like that, that you need to catch every single time. So,
well, you know, yes, things are changing, but at the same time, I think one of the things that, you know, it's almost a meme at this point is like people working on films going out there as part of like the press tours to be like, and it's all practical to increasingly improbable degrees, right? Where you're looking, you're looking at the trailers and you're like, that doesn't look practical. And so I think there's this other weird dynamic happening, which is that as these tools are getting more powerful and they're getting much more widespread and showing up in ways and places that are getting harder and harder to identify, you're seeing this sort of like nostalgia and fetishization of old school filmmaking techniques. And also a degree of like hostility for the VFX and like CGI crafts and sort of a sense that like they diminish filmmaking. And I'm curious like how you internalize, how you make sense of stuff like that, right? Because I'm probably one of those people, like there is something I'm responding to that is in the aesthetic of a lot of modern films that rankles or gets under my skin. But then there are a lot of things where I learn later, dude, that wasn't a location. That wasn't all practical effects. Like that was like those shots you love weren't, it wasn't real, dog. Like I'm watching Shogun right now. Right.
Yeah.
And the behind the scenes stuff is like, okay, that show is like 85% smoke and mirrors every time they set foot outside a room. And so like, When we look at a moment like this, where it's become a sales point to brag about like, and we didn't use any of that CGI shit, it's all real. And you have a lot of people sort of looking at stuff now and saying like, that's bad VFX or that's shitty CGI. Mm-hmm. I want the real stuff. How do you make sense of it? Where do you think it's coming from? And where do you think it leaves like your job? In responding to this sort of like inchoate feeling from audiences?
It's at this point, it is like, to me, almost as annoying as the like, our video games art discourse. where like it's no longer even, it's not a useful conversation anymore, because I think we all kind of know that this is like a marketing technique. And I think that it's, you know, again, like I'm on a show where nobody is going to pretend we did this with real monsters. Like Godzilla's day rate's crazy, man. but you know, we're like, so it's like part of the marketing thing. And, you know, again, I'm very blessed by Apple and Legendary being like super supportive of the visual effects department. There's still some things that, you know, like could be better industry-wide, you know, immaterial to our show, but like this discourse that happens around it is like the recent one that just came up with Tim Burton. You know,
I miss this one. Discourses happen so thick and fast. I miss the Tim Burton discourse.
So, okay.
I assume this is something related to like the return to practical for the new Beetlejuice film.
Exactly. And so the new Beetlejuice movie, you know, from my understanding of people who worked on that project, is like they did do a lot of heavy practical stuff on that project. And so Tim was in an interview saying like he didn't want to do that movie heavily relying on digital work to the same extent that he's done on previous ones. And then that turned into no CGI. And, you know, of course, like Twitter is getting worse and worse every day. And I think it's like stuff like this that is really magnifying that thing where like, you know, even other places where like Nolan said it on Oppenheimer, it definitely was annoying where he said there was no CGI in the movie, but in that case, there sincerely wasn't. There was traditional compositing 2D, you know, visual effects work. I think it still diminishes the work of artists and it sucks. But to me, it's like, it's a matter of like, if he had said like two words differently, nobody would have batted an eye. And so like the magnification of that discourse is really frustrating. But the other part of this is like, you know, thinking about Oppenheimer and thinking about like that practical explosion and everything they do with it lyrically in the edit, like I don't really know how visual effects could have delivered an equivalent product. But when you look at the actual thing, it doesn't really look like a nuclear explosion. So, you know, depending on where you are on the audience spectrum of like, do you want that viscerality or do you want a more literal portrayal? Even though the more literal portrayal is then artificial, like figuring out that filmmaking choice is kind of a difficult thing. And, you know, like Shogun is a great example. Like Last of Us is a great example where, you know, they had prosthetic molds for the faces, but, you know, 70, 80, 90, 99% of the time it's CG because the prosthetic, like unless it's very background, like because the prosthetic, you know, great base to work from, but it just doesn't quite satisfy what everybody wanted.
It's going to hold up to the scrutiny of like 4K, the television show. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So, you know, like I, you know, I think for me personally, it's like more interesting to talk about like, where does it make sense to find ways to do things practically and really embrace those things versus just defaulting to doing CG every single time. Like, you know, we would love to do stuff with puppets on the show. I don't really know how I would do it on our production timetables, on everything else. But like Matt Fraction was like, every single time I'm like, maybe we could do that with a puppet. He's like, yes, do it. You know, but then it just doesn't, you know, again, like the calendar time never makes sense for anything. So it's like, you know, but in terms of like, you know, like personally, it frustrates the heck out of me because it's like, it's robbing people of their work, you know, it's like denying them their, like the actual effort. And for me, like the quality of execution is a thing that I increasingly, even though I'm more and more, you know, like our show was praised for its visual effects work and was, you know, positively received. When a show isn't positively received for its visual effects work, it really doesn't take me out of the story in the same way that it used to, because, you know, you don't know what factors were, you know, playing at this. Like, did the you know, did they have giant third act changes and reshoots and then have to finish the entire third act in two and a half months or something like that, instead of the seven that you would conventionally have for a big third act, right? Like, you don't really know. So you just need to, like, my feeling about it is just like, watch things generously, you know, be generous about how you talk about other people's work. And I think if filmmakers could do that as well as, you know, audiences, then I think we'd probably all have lower blood pressure.
But like, do you think some of that is like, when we're talking about, because again, I think when this discourse was at its most intense, I felt like every week I was opening Twitter, and there was a different clip
from a
different Marvel show. Yeah. And it was just like, look at this. And one thing that, like, you know, when you look at those things that are being sort of held up as like, this is how this stuff is like ruining effects or ruining filmmaking, to some extent, is a lot of this just reflective of like, this is what a troubled or compromised production puts out. This is just the way it looks with visual effects. Like, you know, when I think about the things that people seem to respond to, and the things that I certainly, you know, when I look at a show and it just looks kind of plasticky or unconvincing, right? Like not cinematically interesting. A lot of times that is something I associate with like a very effects heavy production and very, you know, a lot of reliance on like, you know, thinly dressed sound stages. And when we talk about stuff like that, is when we have people pulling those mistakes or highlighting stuff as like, this is an example of how this is not good. You know, as a professional in the field, are people identifying like inherent flaws to like visual effects or CG, or is this just like obviously somebody had to do something fast, or it had to be thrown together? That like, given enough time, can you make anything look good?
I think it really depends what you're talking about, right? Like, you know, a lot of times a movie that is still great, people aren't going to be fixated on the visual effects. I think. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when you're boring an audience, they'll fixate on the bad things. And, you know, I do think that there is like a little bit of an industry-wide, you know, problem of, you know, rushing and other things like that can result in negative products or negatively received products. But, you know, again, it's just like, the discourse about it all just like is kind of frustrating, because I feel like it lacks that like that nuance of like, okay, so I don't know, I'm sure that we can all think of like a movie with bad visual effects that we still enjoyed, right? Like The Host being the thing that I kind of keep going back to, or like, you know, I haven't rewatched this in years, but like when I was younger, like and had much worse taste, you know, I loved Donnie Darko, but those visual effects were terrible then, right? Like,
well, all effects age, right? Yeah. Like even, you know, if I was to show my kid, you know, movies from the 70s, 80s, 90s that are largely, as we're calling them, practical effects, she's going to look at that and go, Dad, like, it was the same way that I was telling you about The Man in Suit. Like, that looked amazing to me when I was a kid. And now you look at that and go like, yeah, but why wouldn't you just want Godzilla, you know, the big, you know, computer one that looks like so much scare? And it's like all effects, however they're made, whether it's handcrafted, whether it's, you know, handcrafted on a computer, they're going to age. And it's a matter of like what surrounded those effects that I think is kind of what you're getting at.
And part of it is like, I do think, you know, part of the philosophy of the show that we're on right now is like, we wanted to go to real locations. Like, we actually did shoot on a glacier for one episode. We went to a desert, you know, we went to Tokyo. We didn't try to do this stuff on sound stages. And it is like part of the ethos of the project. And I think that the more that projects can practically embrace that, the better audiences will receive them. And I think that there is this element of, you know, like if you strain too much, if you don't have the right budget, if you don't have that filmmaking coherence, like, you know, you're going to end up with a project that, you know, clangs for people, right? Like, you know, you go from like a beautifully set decked interior, and then you cut to an exterior, and like, you know, and if it doesn't, if it's not coherent, if it just has that like bad glows over everything, and you know, like looks like it was shot through a, you know, a nylon or something like that, when the rest of the filmmaking doesn't have that stylistic choice, then you're gonna, it's gonna be a problem. But like, part of the issue is that like, sometimes if you're working with things that, you know, if you're working with things that are rushed, like there are these like shortcuts to making things look a little bit less problematic. So, you know, a lens flare will cover, you know, a poorly rendered bit of, you know, environment, or a glow will help cover the fact that, you know, this little bit of you know, the plate on the foreground for an actor against a blue screen has to direct the light versus something that should be a little bit more diffuse, and a little bit of glow over top will help massage it in. And I think that sometimes audiences are really responding negatively to that kind of stuff. To get a little bit more specific about those kinds of things. And I think the issue is like those things that are really, really hard to visualize are, you know, really, really challenging for filmmakers to work with and directors of photography to light. And then it makes it harder for artists to then actually make that stuff look convincing. So, you know, I it's like, there's the problem with it. That question is just, there's like 1,000 answers, right? Like, the VFX Reddit the other day, somebody like put a shit post in there about the visual effects of Dune and complaining about like the crowd cycles in one scene. And I was like, you know, Paul Lambert is the best visual effects supervisor in the industry, bar none. And there is never going to be, it's going to be years before we have another movie that looks as perfect as Dune 2. So like complaining about a crowd cycle is like, okay, what about everything?
What's
else?
What's the standard is, here?
What about the absolutely sublime hour and a half of other visuals that you saw in that film? So again, it's this like that discourse is really frustrating because it's, and I think it is because there is just this like complex answer at the heart of it. And, you know, I, again, like, you know, we were nominated for a Visual Effects Society Award for the first episode. You know, I'm putting together Emmy packages right now, and, you know, a lot of like the media was really positive about a lot of the early reviews were really positive about the visual effects and the monsters and all that kind of stuff. So like, I
can echo it. I watched the show, and like the visuals are spectacular. It's well worth watching if you like this era of Godzilla for sure.
And you know, and like, thank you, but you know, like I'm really blessed for that. And like, you know, part of it is having great creative collaborators and having, you know, like sometimes you get into, you know, you put together visual effects and you present it to the network or the studio, and then they come back with like laundry lists of notes. And that always happens no matter what. Some places you'll like work and you'll say like, I can't do that without more money or more time. And here's, you know, here's the five things that we could do of this list without upending things. And then, you know, sometimes you'll be like, well, you're not going to get more money, you're not going to get more time, and you have to do it all. So at that point it becomes like, okay, well, you just have to like half-ass everything, right? You have to like put your thinking cap on and figure out, okay, how can I achieve this like enormously complicated re-render without re-rendering it? How can you, you know, and other times you work with executives and network people who understand that they don't want to compromise the quality, they trust you, and then you're able to do things in a way that you think is right. And that's very much, fortunately, what our show was. And, you know, that's a positive thumbs up for working with Apple and all that, which I'm sure they'd be happy about me saying, but you know, that's, you know, that again, like it is this, like, it's this really, you know, for the broader industry, I think like, you know, sometimes it is really like, you know, you have $40 million worth of visual effects work, but you have $15 million. So how do you get it done? Right. You know, and even Bong Joon-ho talked about, I rewatched The Host last night, and then I watched a bunch of interviews with him because I was just thinking about it. And he was just talking about like what he had for a visual effects budget on that movie and just like how the whole thing was impossible. So he had to make certain compromises. And it didn't sound like he was happy about making those compromises, to be totally clear. And again, like, to me, that movie is like essential viewing for the genre because it is, you know, it's political, it's funny, it's dramatic, it's heartbreaking. You know, the fact that he was able to do that, but the visual effects don't necessarily hold up is like, well, you know, like, and they're still like pretty cool, fun, engrossing scenes despite it. So I contest a lot of that discourse, but I also just don't have the mental energy to give any thought to it. Right. You know?
Well, maybe one last thing to leave it on is sort of as you think across your body of work, you know, stuff that you've worked on as an artist and even now in your role where you're overseeing a lot of stuff. And this doesn't have to be just within the monsterverse, within Godzillas and monsters and kaijus. But do you have like a particular visual effect or something that you were involved in that you still sort of think about or are proud of, like one that like your mind just goes back to that you got to be a part of in some way?
The Halo jump is like to go to a Godzilla thing is like
hell yeah, pretty, the Halo jump.
pretty ridiculous. And that was a really funny one where like we'd sort of been working on that sequence and then they wanted to do the trailer and then they framed the trailer around the Halo jump. And so
one of the best trailers, like I think about that trailer, like when I don't have time to rewatch that movie, I just rewatched that trailer and I'm able to expel some of that energy before I find the time to watch the movie.
That's amazing. We were working on the trailer and our visual effects supervisor when the like start of that marketing push came in was actually on vacation. And so we had another guy sort of stepping in and trying to figure out how to do it all. And like, you know, the assets weren't ready, all the stuff, but like we got, it really like, again, going back to that aspect of like painting, you know, I did the final shots of that portion of the trailer where you're like seeing Godzilla for the first time and you're like wrapping around it. And that scene was just like a complete mess when we had to press render because this marketing request came in. And so like a thing that you'll never notice, but you know, Godzilla is in that shot floating 1,000 meters above the ground for the first half of it because because he wasn't the right size. And as the camera is coming down, he is dropping to the ground. So talking about like how do you like, so I'm trying to like put dust elements and things around him to like haze him and get him like get that obscuring quality to him. And as he's dropping to the ground, I'm like, okay, I'm having to animate this plane. And I like, yeah, I look at it in 3D space and I'm like, oh my God. Okay. So, so then you start fixing all the problems and you know, like when our supervisor did get back from vacation, like he cut it short and came back in help us figure it out. You know, he would just sit at my desk, like, well, you know, we'd have like a movie on the side and then just like noodle on things and like, you know, the lightning was like Guillaume Rochonnel. He does lightning better than anybody. It's a weird, like specific thing that he is just like amazing at visualizing and doing. And we would just be sitting and dialing the lighting and he'd be like, okay, take a depth path of the scene, invert it, put a radial here, multiply it by these 7 lights. Now go here, do this, you know, and oh just like, God. Like really like getting that like emotional thing out of it. And then suddenly, and I'm like, oh, this isn't going to, oh shit. Yeah, it worked. You know, second version it's done. And then, you know, like the version that's in the feature is a completely different action for the monsters. And so, you know,
interesting,
like, cause you have the Muto in it with Godzilla and they're fighting
right,
and they
right,
get pushed
right.
out of frame and it's longer in the trailer version. And so when, you know, that shot, it took us like, you know, it took me like 15 days of compositing and then animators and lighting people and effects artists on top of that. You know, going back quite a while. And then when I picked it up for the feature, it was like, it took me a day you know, it took me 2 days. And then we sent it version one final, you know, one of the other studios was in the theater with Gareth, and they were like, how the hell did they do that? Version one. So it's because we already did it. But amazing. You know, like that kind of stuff was like really, really exciting for me. And then I'm trying to think if there's anything on this show that I like, you know, yeah, that's an interesting one. Like the show, a lot of it was just, we, you know, revisit the Godzilla 2014 on the bridge. We go back to Kong Skull Island. I think that like one of the things that really resonated for me is in the first episode, like, you know, we, the basically our heroes are being swarmed by these insect-like monsters. One of the characters is hanging precariously over top of a pit, and the monsters have swarmed her so much that she's now too heavy and the grip is letting go and she drops. When we saw that, like, even at the post-viz phase, and we were putting the edits together, Chris Black watched it and he was like, episode done. There was a whole other scene that was supposed to happen after it. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, boom, no, that's the ending of the scene. And just like getting to then execute that of like, boom, you know, time it up to the music. Everything was like, was really satisfying to get that. Like, you know, when I finally saw it cut together, everything in there, with Leo's score and everything else, it was just like, oh, it's gonna work, the show is gonna work, you know. And that was really exciting.
Excellent. Well, this has been super informative. Like, we really appreciate you taking the time. You know, I mentioned earlier while we were talking about it, but if you like the 2014 film, if you've liked the Edwards interpretation of Godzilla, and like I have, and I've been following this series all along, I highly recommend checking out Monarch Legacy of Monsters, which is on Apple TV Plus right now. Sean, anything else you want to shout out that you're working on, or you can point people towards beyond Legacy of Monsters?
No, not the second. If you're part of the Emmys, Emmy Academy, please vote for us. This won't go live for a bit, right?
Next week, I think.
Next week? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, if you can go back in time, I'll be on a panel at the Directors Guild with Kurt Russell, which is a very weird thing. So
hell yes. Excellent. All right. Well, thanks, Sean, so much. Thanks to everyone at Remap for listening. We'll be back with another episode real soon.